I am an alcoholic. My name is Jimmy Mack. And thank you, Larry and Damien, for asking me to come here and share part of my story with you. It's an honor and privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not be here if it wasn't for this program. I'd be pushing up daisies somewhere. Of that, I am convinced. And happy birthday to the birthday recipients, Judy, Rahulio, Chuck, and Victor, who also announced, although he didn't come up, he said he just got a year in 7 days. Congratulations. That's awesome. And congratulations to everybody in the room. You know, June 10th, Tuesday, AA celebrated 79 years of sobriety. And so it was 79 years ago that this program started that has saved the lives of so many alcoholics. And I don't know about you, but I am really grateful for Bill and Bob for getting this thing off the ground, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. And, you know, this is a miraculous program. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. The book says it's a design for living, and it is. It's designed for living that works when everything else fails, if you're an alcoholic of my type, and or if you're an alcoholic like Nikki's type from Kentucky. You know, I loved Kentucky bourbon, Jack Daniels or Wild Turkey. And the only reason why I switched to vodka was because Kentucky bourbon makes you stink pretty bad. So pretty hard to disguise Kentucky bourbon. But I love Kentucky bourbon. If I could drink it today, I'd still be drinking it. But unfortunately, I suffer from a malady, a spiritual malady and a physical allergy and a mental obsession that once I put any alcohol into my system whatsoever, all bets are off on what's going to happen after that. So fortunately for me, I've come to understand that dilemma, and I don't have to do that anymore. And I want to thank my beautiful wife, Christy, for being here with me tonight, and her sponsors here. And my wife is a black belt Al-Anon 10th degree. And the reason why I'm here today is because she found the program of Al-Anon and gently coaxed me into this program. I was one of those functional drunks that Nikki described and didn't think I had a problem. And, you know, June 22nd, by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my wife and I will celebrate 29 years of marriage. We've been together for 33 years, but we'll be married 29. My sobriety date is March 10th, 1993, so I'm only sober 21. So my wife got to endure that last 9 years of just incomprehensible demoralization. That's the best I can describe it. I'll share a little bit about my story just so I can qualify. I started drinking when I was 13 years old. I remember my first drunk like it was yesterday. And it was right around the corner at a little park called Colina del Sol. It was at a CYO youth dance, Catholic Youth Organization dance. And my friend Jose and I had a plan that we were going to drink. And, you know, I was a skinny little kid. I was about 5'3", weighed about 115 pounds, soaking wet. And we got a six-pack of tall Colt 45s, and I chugged down two of them, and that's all I could get down. And we knew that if we chugged it down and ate a pack of Sensen's, we could get back past the chaperones and get into the dance without being detected. And so that's what we did. And as soon as I got inside the dance, that stuff hit, and my world changed from black and white to Technicolor. You know, I left that dance 3 hours later, soaking wet. The crotch of my pants ripped from doing the splits. James Brown and was the popular dance back then. And I had a girlfriend. You know. And for a scared-to-death kid who didn't feel comfortable in his own skin, who couldn't talk to women or girls at that time, and just didn't know how to do life, you know, that was miraculous. And that became... that became what I did at every given opportunity after that. So I'm convinced that I was an alcoholic from the get-go. And even if I wasn't physically an alcoholic yet at that point, I suffered from the alcoholic dilemma, which was I suffered from self-centered fear that I'm not enough, that there's not enough, and that I'm going to lose something that I have or not get something that I really want. And that fear dominated my life until I got in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And even in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, if I'm honest. And sometimes, even today, you know, sometimes that fear creeps up and I have to take a look at it and give it up to God and realize that I don't have to go there. I don't have to live there, you know. My sponsor today is a gentleman by the name of Ken D. And he always tells me that, remember, this is just a joke. Life is a joke and we're the punchline. And we need to learn to laugh at ourselves and our dilemma. And he has the ability to wear life like a loose cloth. And I'm attracted to that. The people that I'm attracted to in Alcoholics Anonymous who have what I wanted when I drank. That sense of ease and comfort that I only got from taking the drink of alcohol. So I'm kind of attracted to the people that are smiling, laughing, have that sparkle in their life, that seem to be able to get through life and enjoy life. And they learn how to do that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. These weren't skills that they had before they got here. These are skills they acquired after they came into this program and got active in a program of recovery that saved their life. And although this meeting didn't read how it works, you know, most meetings in Southern California read how it works, which is kind of a blueprint for how this deal works. And it's not a tough program. It's a lot easier than we make it out to be, or at least I found that to be the case with me, although I fought it for a long time. I didn't want to do everything that was suggested because you don't understand, my case is different. And I held on to my old ideas longer than I needed to, and they served me no useful purpose, and I created a lot of wreckage in sobriety the first years of sobriety because I was suffering from what's known as untreated alcoholism. In the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing what to say to sound good in front of a bunch of people and get the attaboys and pats on the back, I'd listen to people talk in the meetings, and they would quote page 448, the chapter on acceptance, or they'd quote page 83 and 84 of the promises, or, you know, any number of quotes, and everybody would come up to them afterwards and go, oh, boo-boo, I really loved your share, and they'd get the accolades, and I wanted that acceptance and approval. That's what I hungered for my whole life. I wanted something to fill that hole in my soul. And I found that if I did that, I could get those pats on the back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I did. I came in here and I was a chameleon. I was a poser. I was doing the same thing that I did. The reason why I drank is because I wanted you to like me. It didn't matter so much that I liked you, but it was really important that you liked me. And I would do anything and become whatever you wanted me to be to get your acceptance and approval. And, you know, I want to thank Joey for staying here. He saw that I was talking tonight, and he said, I'm going to stay anyway, so thank you, Joey. There's some people that are in this room that I looked up to, that I still look up to, and you know who you are. And the reason why is because they've modeled this program to me. You know, I'm a little slow on the uptake. I read this literature, and a lot of times it doesn't really make sense to me. Like, when agitated, we pause. Damn it, when I'm agitated, I'm agitated. The last thing I want to do is pause. And my sponsor, who was my spiritual mentor and my advisor for 12 years, Peter Fleischman, who's in that big meeting in the sky right now, told me, he said, well, Jim, he says, you know, I was telling him about that. We were having a discussion about some of the literature and the readings, and I said, you know, I'm agitated, Peter. The last thing I want to do is pause. And he goes, Jim, he says, what that looks like for you is, at that time, I just lost a prime contract, and I was in all kinds of fear. I thought I was going to lose my house, lose my business, lose my wife, my family, because that contract represented who I was at that moment. I thought that I had turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is when I was 10 years sober. And what I discovered was that, no, I was still worshiping money, property, and prestige. And the loss of that contract put all that stuff, made it real. And I had to take a look at my behavior in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, what that looks like for you, Jim, is when you come home from work, you stop at the bottom of the hill. I smoked at the time. He said, take 10 minutes to smoke a cigarette and deep breathe. Leave all that work stuff at the bottom of the hill. Remember that you're coming home to people that love you and want to spend time with you, my wife and my children. And he said, you don't have to bring that home to them. For you, that's what when agitated pause looks like. And so I started practicing that. And it made a horrific difference in our relationship. Because I wasn't bringing all that stuff that I had no control over that I thought I could, I would bring home and I would take it out on my wife and kids. By not physically abusive, but verbally abrasive. You know, I would yell or get angry or make mean faces and, you know, do stuff that just didn't work, but trying to make myself feel better at their expense. And I learned I didn't have to do that, that there was a better way to do things, that I'm powerless over all that stuff anyway. But there's one who has, you know, in our literature we read and how it works, that there's a sentence that I think it's overlooked, or just we read it so often people don't take heed of it, but it says, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And I hope that you found what I found in this program, and that's a loving higher power that is there to support me and to take care of all my needs. And all I have to do is let go. You know, the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous is we admit we are powerless over alcohol, that our life has become unmanageable. And that is the only step in the book that says that you must do perfectly. And if you don't admit you're powerless, you're holding on to a dirty little secret, you're probably going to go out and test the waters again. I was taught that the way you do the steps is by doing the next step, that each step prepares us by being humble enough to accept the next proposition that you're about to encounter. So the way you do step one is by doing step two. And that, you know, I became willing to accept a higher power that can restore my life to sanity. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity is how I do step one. And the way you do step two is by doing step three. I turn my will and my life over to the care of that higher power. And the way, the manifestation of step three is by doing step four, because if you've turned your life, if I've turned my life and my will over to the care of this higher power, then step four shouldn't be so scary. All I'm doing is writing a list. God already knows all that stuff anyway. If I'm trusting in him that has all power, it should be an easy proposition for me to take. So, and I fumbled with that, and it wasn't because I was scared of doing step four, it's because I didn't want to tell anybody my deepest, darkest secrets, because I didn't want to be judged. And the way we do step four is by doing step five. We freely admit it to another human being and to our higher power. And each one prepares us by getting us humble to take on the next proposition. You know, when we finally get the way you do step five is students six and seven. You identify those flaws in your makeup that make you act out the way that you do, right? Your character defects is how they put them. Or the seven deadly sins is how my sponsor put it to me. And if you've identified that, you ask God to remove it. You know, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And the seventh step prayer, it says, you know, God, I'm now really, you should take all of me, good and bad. I now ask that you remove every defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness. To you and my fellows, grant me peace as I go from here to do your bidding. Which means to me that some of those character defects you're probably going to keep, because they serve a useful purpose of maybe what not to do. You know, I know that's been the case with me. You know, I've had loving people come up and remind me that, hey, you know, if you're still doing it, it's not old behavior. You know. You know, I used to love to sit in the meetings and judge everybody that was around me. Nothing feeds the ego more than to sit in judgment of my fellow man. Because what I'm doing is I'm playing God. I'm saying that I'm better than you are. That my way's right, your way's wrong. And you know, in the steps, there's no right or wrong. There's no, you know, the better question to ask is, how's that working for you? Because somebody may be able to do something that I can't do. It doesn't mean that it's right or wrong for them, or good or bad for them. It may trigger my jealousy or my greed, or because I can't do what they can do, or they seem to be able to get away with something with impunity that I can't. But that doesn't mean it's wrong for them. You know, I used to really get angry at people that could go to one meeting a week and then have a seemingly normal life. You know, go out to all these functions and parties, and I just couldn't do that. You know, if I didn't go to my my meetings, if I missed a couple of days, I'm crazy as a bat. You know, I just and I'd get angry that I had to do all this stuff. Why do I have to do this stuff and they don't? And am I sick? Or that, you know, they can't be any better than me. And the bottom line is, I don't know whether they are or not. I don't live at their house. I don't live in their shoes. I don't know what their life's like out of the meeting. So, you know, that I needed to learn to put all that judgment stuff aside, because it doesn't serve me a good purpose, nor does it serve my fellow man. and it shuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And I used to like to participate in malicious gossip, you know, character assassination by another name. And again, it was me playing God. It was me saying that I'm better than somebody else. And so I try to keep myself in check when I find myself doing that today. I try not to do that because, you know, I haven't walked. The Indians have a saying, unless you walk a mile in someone else's moccasins, you really can't. You don't know what they've gone through. Most of the stuff we have is experiential. You know, the stuff that I do, if two people witness an accident and you ask them to tell it what they saw, you'll get two different stories. Now, they may be there at the same time seeing the same thing, but their stories that they recant are different because their experience in life was different, which enabled them to see things differently than I see things. And that's what I've learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my job is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows, which means, you know, the only thing I have is my story, which is my experience, strength, and hope. It's what I've learned as a result of doing these propositions and that I try to apply into my life on a daily basis to the best of my ability that has given me the freedom that I have today. And if you know, this is supposed to be a program of attraction rather than promotion. So the reason why I was attracted to those people with the sparkle in their eyes and the lightness in their step and the song in their heart and the ability to laugh at themselves is because that's what I wanted. And I think that's what we all want deep down inside. We all want that freedom from bondage that we had from life. You know, the literature says that the normal state of the alcoholic is restless, irritable, and discontent. That's without the alcohol. You know, unless he can at once find that sense of ease and comfort that he gets immediately by taking a drink. That's what the literature tells me. Well, I want that. I want that. I don't want to be restless, irritable, and discontent. I want that sense of ease and comfort. And the secret to doing it is by being of service to your fellow man. The more I am concerned about you and what I can do for you, the more free I am. And that principle applies in every aspect of my life. It's been my experience. When I do that at work, when I get worried about I'm not making my margins, they're screwing me, you know. I didn't take the time to bid the job right, and I left out something, and all of a sudden I'm upside down. You know, it's not their fault. You know, I need to be a little bit more thorough in what I'm doing. My job was, I signed up for it, I volunteered for it, I gave them the price, I have to honor that commitment. I have to honor my commitments with my family. You know, I'm through taking hostages, you know, and that's what I did for a long time. Is I took hostages. Everybody is sponsored or sponsors people in a different way. And the way I was taught to sponsor people is you sponsor them through your example. I don't mandate or dictate that anybody do anything because I don't really care whether you do or not. The literature tells me if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you'll do what we do. It's a monkey see, monkey do program. If what I'm doing isn't attractive to you and you need to find someone else to work with that has something that's more attractive, by all means do that, please. You know, it's more important that you stay sober than it is that you're my friend or that you work with me or do something that I, according to my specifications. So, this is a miraculous program. The longer I'm sober, the less I know. And there's a tremendous amount of freedom in that because I don't have to have all the answers. You know, I have to live life to the best of my ability, knowing that I'm a fallible child of a loving God. And that I'm going to make mistakes. But I know where to turn now when that happens. I didn't know that when I came. Steps 8 and 9 in the big book is where, you know, a lot of people are afraid of 4 and 5, but, you know, the real work starts when you do those direct amends. When we got to step 8, when I was sharing that with my sponsor, I made my list, and He asked me if I still had my fourth step list, and the big literature refers to referring to our list again. You know, hopefully you've retained that list. And if you're like me, you probably have some stuff to add to it. And some of the hardest amends I had to make weren't the financial restitution amends or the stuff that I thought would be difficult. They were the amends that I had to make my family and loved ones. Some of them are an ongoing process. They're called living amends. It's how I conduct myself today. It's the kind of father that I am towards my kids, the kind of husband I am towards my wife. But I remember my dad was dying, and this is when I was 13 years sober. And I'd heard about all these guys in the program that had made these, that had to make these amends to their dead dads after the fact. And they'd write letters and put them on the grave. And I went up to Peter, my sponsor at the time, and I told him, I said, I don't want to be one of those guys that writes the letter after my dad. My dad's still alive. I need to make an amends. There's some stuff that's not right that I don't feel good about. I hated my dad. I hated my dad from the time I was a young boy. And he said, what I want you to do is I want you to go ahead and write that letter as if your dad had passed away. And I want you to write down everything that you hate about your dad. All the times he wasn't there for you as a kid. All the times he didn't support you in Little League and Boy Scouts. You know, all the stuff that the times he embarrassed you. The times he beat you when you didn't think you deserved it. All that stuff that has been the venom in your life for so long, I want you to write it down. And then he said, what I want you to do is I want you to turn that page over and I want you to write down all the times that maybe you were an embarrassment to him. My dad was a teetotaler. My dad was a teetotaler because my grandfather was an alcoholic. And when my Uncle Paul died, my grandfather was a doctor. He bought the house that we lived in over on 60th and Redwood. And when my Uncle Paul died, thank you. I needed that. Now, if this was alcohol, this would be over. He died of spinal meningitis before they had modern antibiotics or penicillin, and my grandfather turned his back on God and became a raging alcoholic and was very abusive to my dad. My dad escaped by going to joining the Army in World War II and fought in the Battle of the Bulge with Patton in the 6th Armored Division and came back, and I think he had serious post-traumatic stress disorder, and he wasn't a very good provider. There was a lot of things that my dad suffered from, and I didn't understand all that stuff. And I had to write down, and my mother was a teetotaler also because her parents were alcoholics, and when she was 9 years old, her parents put her in St. Anne's Orphanage in Long Beach because they could no longer take care of her. So she was raised by the nuns, and when she was 18, as soon as she got out of the orphanage, she met my dad and they got married. So he had two dysfunctional alcoholics, basically, that didn't drink. They should have. I mean, it would have been so much easier on his kids. But they didn't. But they hated alcohol. They hated anything to do with it. So I had to write down all the times that I was an embarrassment to my dad. I used to drink at my dad. I knew it pissed him off, and I'd drink just to piss him off. I had to write down the time he bailed me out of jail. You know, if you get popped for a 502, you know you're not getting out of the drunk tank until 7 o'clock in the morning. But I called my dad. He came down and sat in the jail until 7 o'clock when I got released and drove me to get my car. Back then, they didn't impound them. I'm a little older than a lot of people in here, so we went down on Midway Drive and picked up my car and drove it home. What happened during this process was I used to hate the fact that my family was poor. And there was six kids. There was eight of us in a two bedroom, one bath, 950 square foot house. And there wasn't a lot to go around. Every Sunday we'd have one chicken for dinner with potatoes and whatever vegetable my mom could get on sale. And eight people, you do the math. It's not a lot of, it's one piece of chicken per person. And my dad used to always say, my favorite part is the neck and the back. Well, everybody knows there's no meat on the neck and the back. My dad used to had one pair of dress shoes that he wore every Sunday. Well, he also wore them to paint in, to work in, because that was his only pair of shoes. And he did without shoes so that his kids could have shoes. And what I learned was that my perception, you know, alcoholism is a perceptual disease. My perceptions were all screwed up. My dad was probably the most generous, loving, and kindest man that was around, and I couldn't see that because I was so obscured by my need to get what I wanted. What about me? I was selfish and self-centered from the get-go. And then I was charged with the responsibility to go to the hospital every day and tell my dad I love him and to be the best son I could be. And my dad wasn't a man of many words. He never said, I love you. My dad's idea of a compliment was, that's okay for a hair lip. When I would do something, when I started my business, and I had a very successful business, he would say, that's okay for a hair lip. He used to drive my wife insane because she didn't come from that kind of a household. And one day, I just rebuilt a house, demoed a house in Del Cerro and rebuilt it. And I was really proud of it. It turned out really, really nice. And we had my parents over for dinner, and I said, what do you think, Dad? And he goes, that's okay for a hair lip. And my wife just goes, oh, God, you know, I can't believe it. And what happened was, this was after I had done that amends, I realized that that's as good as it's ever going to get. He never got that as a child. Why would I expect him to be able to do it for me? And what I got was a lot of forgiveness and a lot of love. And that's the other thing we learn in this program, which is so vitally important. After the promises on page 83 and 84, on the bottom of the next paragraph, it says, love and tolerance of others is our code. We have a code of conduct here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't matter where you come from, what color you are, how big, small, what gender you are, what your preferences are. My job is to be loving and tolerant. It doesn't mean that I have to accept everything you do, but I have to love you for the person that you are, because everybody has something positive to offer. And, you know, if I get nothing out of the steps, then what happened was my dad finally died, obviously. The day before he died, I went to the hospital and I told him, I said, Dad, you know, you can let go. You fought a good fight. We've got it from here. We can take it from here. What would you have me do? Because that's what I was directed to do when I make an amends, to make him face to face. And you ask, what would you have me do to make this right? Whether it's financial, whether it's emotional, whatever the case might be. And he said, son, take care of your mother. I love you. That which I wanted all my life, I got. He wasn't able to do that before. If I got nothing else from this program, this miraculous program that has saved my life, I'm overpaid. And what that did is it enabled me to become a better father to my sons. Because as much as I didn't want to be like my dad, that was my role model. I emulated my dad's behavior. If you ever watch a son and a dad walking down the street, if the dad has a particular gait or talks a certain way, the kid will be lockstep, he'll have the same gait, talk the same way. I mean, they just absorb everything that their parents are. And that's what they become until hormones kick in at 12 and 13. And then all bets are off after that. But when they become an adult, those old patterns that were established in their childhood manifest themselves in their behaviors, because that's their fallback position. That's their default position. And I would find myself saying stuff, and I'd go, Jesus, that was Norman. You know, it was just like my dad. And I understand why he did it today. And I try not to do that. And sometimes I still, if something's upsetting to me, I still get a little animated. And I'm reminded that Norman's still very, very much alive in his son. But we're doing better. And the same with my mom. I had a similar experience with my mom. Those were the hard amends. And the amends to my wife, my poor wife, you know, the last 9 years, the party was over. It had been over for a long time. I didn't know it, but everybody else did. We stopped being invited to as many functions because I'd started my drinking early in the day, and by 7 o'clock, I was pretty blottoed. I'd black out every night. I'd start my day off in the morning with a line of Crystal in my coffee just so I could get started. And then everything was off after that. And that poor woman had to endure that. And so when I'd come home, a lot of times, my home was my sanctuary, and I expect that house to be immaculate. Yeah, after all, you know, I worked to support this family and blah, blah, blah. The carpet had to be pattern backing, had to have diamonds, and all the dots had to be connected. It was pretty insidious, actually. But that's what I expected from my wife. And if it wasn't done, there was going to be hell to pay. Oh, man, I'm so glad to be free from that stuff. Whew. God, what a wonderful program this is. I mean, how many people here have less than a year? You know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find in this program what I've found. And if you're like me, don't expect a quick fix. You know, for me, in the back of the book, there's a spiritual appendix. And it talks about Bill's blinding flashlight that he, a spiritual experience that he had in the hospital room. And it says, but most of us aren't like that. For most of us, this happens slowly over a long period of time. And for me, the growth and recovery has happened slowly over a long period of time. At 21 years of sobriety, I'm reasonably free today. I turn to my God before I turn to other things. I'm pretty happy. I'm a pretty happy guy. I've had some horrific things happen in the last couple of years that would justify anybody going out and doing whatever they needed to do. You know, I haven't found it necessary to do that. And I found forgiveness for some of the people that did some of the horrific things. And I have love in my heart for them. And I walk a free man. I am free from the bondage of self, for the most part. That doesn't mean that I can't take it back. My higher power is a very loving higher power, and I have free will. I can take back that towel that I surrender up anytime I want to. The payoff is always sure and swift for me. It always results in hurt feelings, the necessity for me to have to make an amends to somebody, which I don't like doing. And, you know, a big dose of eaten crow. I don't care much for crow. I'd much rather have roast turkey. you know, if you... And I'm still attracted to those old-timers that have the sparkle in their eye, the lightness in their step, and the ability to laugh at themselves. Because it teaches me that, you know, hey, that's all we got. So if you're new, look after the old-timers. You know, revere your old-timers. If you're an old-timer, look after the newcomers. Because we're all we've got. And we're only on loan. We're on loan from a loving higher power. And we need to take really good care of each other. So God bless you, and God bless Alcoholics Anonymous.